So getting yourself warm and cozy and padded up, nice. Good. Checking your posture. And calming the body and the mind. And once more, setting the scenario up in your mind. And you begin to feel very heavy. Weighed down. Sinking. Sinking. And the form our brigade now is losing its power and can't sustain its consciousness. Limbs thin and loose. Can't open or close my eyes. And the vision that I have has no colour. It's slightly dark and unclear. All vitality and luster has gone. And the earth element that goes with the form aggregate loses its power, giving temporary boost to the water element. And now a vision appears to my mind of a silver blue mirage. There's no feeling within my body mind now of pleasure or pain or indifference. And the feeling aggregate therefore is losing its power and can't sustain its consciousness. I can't hear. And even the internal humming that's been with me since birth has gone. My body is inert. My mouth, my tongue, my throat, so dry. No saliva. And all my fluids are drying. There will be scum over my teeth now. And the water element linked to the feeling aggregate loses its power and gives temporary brilliance to the fire element. My vision changes now. And I see smoke, puffs of thin, billowing up smoke. My sense of smell has gone. So my discrimination aggregate is losing its power and can't sustain that consciousness. I pay attention to no one. I can't remember names. Who are these people? My breathing is changing. It's difficult now. When I breathe in, it's quite short. And when I breathe out, it seems to be longer. And people in the room will hear a rattling sound, gasping. The fire element linked to the discrimination aggregate loses its power, giving the wind element a little bit more power. And in that brief enhancement of power, my vision changes. And I see now sparks of fire, like from a bonfire. Or like fireflies. I can't move my tongue now. And so the aggregate of compositional factors, mental volition, is losing its power and can no longer support its consciousness. My tongue now is thick, short, with a kind of bluish root. There is no taste, no experience of touch. And my external breath has stopped completely. But there's still a subtle breath. Death has not yet occurred. And the wind element that is connected to the compositional factors loses its power and its consciousness. And the vision that arises to me now is of a candle flame, a kind of dim red-blue flame, flickering, flickering. And slowly the flickering steadies. And there is a steady flame. Now, the five sense minds are no more, and the luminous, knowing nature of the mind emerges. And this mind still has different levels, gross to very subtle. And now the concepts begin to lose their power, lose their purchase. And the 80 gross concepts, such as thoughts of fear, anger, jealousy, joy, all lose their power. And this allows the different subtle levels of minds of consciousness to manifest. These are much more subtle. And the vision is now of a mind of white appearance. It's luminous. Open. Unobstructed, like an autumn sky suffused by white light and nothing else. And as the mind of white light dissolves, the more subtle mind of red increase arises, and the vision is of a vivid red-orange sky and nothing else. And as the mind of red increase dissolves, the more subtle mind of black near attainment. And there is awareness of a blackness, then unconsciousness. The mind begins to emerge from this unconsciousness, becoming more and more subtle, and the unconsciousness clears, and the mind of clear light manifests. And this is the final death vision. A very clear light, the sky of an autumn dawn, completely empty, the fundamental, innate mind of clear light. And here the yogi will stay and practice. Directly realizing emptiness. With the possibility of full enlightenment. But for the rest of us, this very subtlest mind now leaves the body and true death occurs. It's possible that others will see a trickle of red blood at the nose, white fluid from the sex organs, than the very subtle mind that leaves the body now. Because it retains the habit of attachment to self, with the fear of I am becoming non-existent, craves and creates the Bardo body. And so the processes, the eight stages, occur in reverse order. The vision of clear light. The vision of vivid black near attainment. The vision of red increase. The vivid white appearances. The flame. The fireflies. The puffs of smoke. And the mirage. And suddenly you have a Bardo body. Often in the shape of your next rebirth. If a human, then you're a childlike, between 5 and 7 years old. And your Bardo body is very light, like a dream body, indestructible. Can move through walls, there's nothing to resist. And you have psychic powers. You can transport yourself to wherever you wish to be. But with all of this, the suffering is quite high. The fear, the visions that come, the visions that come that you think are real and solid. And we're blown about by these karmically created visions and fear. Desperate, craving for a body. Searching, searching. And you come across a couple making love, your future parents. You enter through the crown of the father. Travel down the central channel. And you travel with the semen from the father into the womb of the mother. And there you become established. And you begin to grow. And at the time of birth, what will be your circumstances? they will be karmically driven, but not set in stone. But what is sure is the cycle of suffering continues. Perpetual, revolving, the circle of samsara. Again and again. Thank you. So I'd like you in pairs, in one set of three. And I'm going to check you after 20 minutes. But here's what I'd like, because we're doing Lam Rim and we're not doing a specific 2 to 3, 4 days on death. We can't cover everything, okay? But what I'd like you to discuss is, so far, what did you feel about the death meditation? Difficult, easy, frightened, I want to practice. Which part of the death meditation made more impact? So concentrate on the death meditation in particular. And the second part I want you to look at is, knowing all this, you know, and you think to yourself, I wish I could have done something. You know, you're on your deathbed, eh? You're thinking, I wish I'd done this, I wish I'd done that. What type of preparation could you do now to make sure that you have a good death? What should you do? And I'm saying that because most of us want to discuss what I do for someone else. How can I help someone else? Yes? If that comes in, fine. But really, how can I make my death? Because you can help, the more you understand, the more you know, the more you're able to help others. But if that comes in, not to worry. So are we clear? I'll check you after 20 minutes. Thank you. If we were doing a long weekend or a course on death and dying, all the points you bring up now we'd be able to go into in great depth. Okay. So what we can only do at the moment is broadly look where we are and where we could be. So if I ask you about the death meditation itself, what type of feedback would you give?
And I was saying it's actually quite exciting.
Exciting.
It's just discovering that's, you know, happening each time before we sleep. It's, you know, going to happen when we die, and just being able to be conscious of it. How amazing.
Yeah. And some people are really good at falling asleep mindfully. You know, they can do it. It takes, to be honest, shamatha helps. I mean, shamatha helps with everything, right? But being able to relax the body totally. I mean, really. When you think you can't relax anymore, relax more. Go deeper. Having that relaxation, deep relaxation of the body and a stillness, but with a mind that's vivid. Not going here and there and thinking about past events, but focused on something gentle like the breath. You can fall asleep like that, if you can't. Then it's possible to pick up at least the first stage and notice the sinking feeling. I mean, most of us, maybe many of you here already have that. You see people, don't you, falling asleep? You know, and it's not just the falling over. You know, it's almost like you start to sink, and it's like a weight, and you suddenly get up quickly and you think, what was that? This mimics dying people. If you've ever been with someone that's dying and they're going through that stage, they often want to be lifted up. Lift me up, lift me up. And they're almost clawing onto the bedclothes trying to pull themselves up. And this is to counteract that sinking feeling. So most people can get a wee taste of that, at least that. But the other visions also. The other visions also. Verse 4. And if you can do that, it's wonderful. You know? Things are not so scary if you've been there before. And what that can lead to you becoming aware and awake in your own dream. So instead of being a bardo body coming, it's a dream body. And you know you're dreaming. You're asleep, but you know you're dreaming. And if you know you're dreaming and you're asleep, then you have the powers. Well, not all of the powers, but a lot of the powers of a bardo body. You can do almost anything you want. You can travel, you can fly, you can meet your teacher, you can do a lot of things. However, it does take training because you can lose it very quickly. I mean, many people report knowing that they're being so excited by knowing that they're dreaming that wake up immediately. You know, so there is training here, but it's possible. And the fundamental of all that is having a deeply, deeply relaxed body and an alert mind that's focused. And it's not tight. This focus is not... It's very gentle. Very gentle. And some people can fall asleep like that and go through those stages. Then, of course, some people can't fall asleep like that, but they can wake up and dream anyway. You know, that's possible. You don't have to go through all those stages. It's just a bit easier if you do, and it's helpful. It doesn't necessarily have to be. So harnessing, even going to sleep, becomes a dharma practice. Instead of becoming a kind of... You know, instead of that. And because the bardo, the dream body, mimics a lot of the bardo body, that's very, that would, you know, what the yogi says, very helpful in the bardo. Very helpful. Anything else? So it was exciting. Okay. You couldn't make it up, could you? I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. Really. It's a template for a really good sequel to all the Matrix films. Yes. Was there any part of that meditation that struck home more than another?
I mean, like the fire sparks and the fireflies vision for some reason. That really
you like that?
Yeah. Is that before the white vision? Is that where that one comes?
Yeah. Don't worry, you've got it there. It's good to it is good to memorize the visions. I mean that's quite nice. It's quite nice. If you memorize that, then the idea of elements and aggregates and things that can be added later. Really, you know, that gives you an idea. It keeps you on track. But if you know the sequence of visions, that alone is very helpful. That alone is very helpful.
So I do get lost in the black vision, you know. I kind of have a mental awareness of going towards white light, but somehow the black vision just brings in dullness and a lot of sinking.
It is. I mean, even meditating on it is very difficult. It's like a blackout. I feel, you know, what comes to me is somebody drawing blackout curtains. That's how it feels, you know. There is light, and then. And it's like a faint. But before that, there is this black and then a faint. And then it is, I find it, and then it gets more and more subtle. It lifts more and more subtle. And then the clear light. Yeah. What I find difficult is some of the descriptions, like the autumn sky. things like this. It's not how I think. No, it isn't. I mean, I have no poetic nature at all. When they were handing out that type of thing, they passed me by. But it's interesting that because I've seen the skies like that now, then the colours become quite important to me. The colours. And here, if you ever see the sunset on a clear night here in the west, oh, it's amazing. Here, it's like a slow spread of red-orange along the line, along the horizon. And then the whole sky takes it up. It's beautiful. Beautiful. I remember that. I use the colours. The other descriptions, and I mean, it's good, and I'm sure a lot of people find it helpful. For me, no. The colour's fine. Anything else?
Barry and I were discussing that as you're going through everything, you're going through part, how long are each of the stages?
It's all different.
It seems very quick when we're meditating.
Well, yeah, because I could take hours doing it, or I could take 5 minutes doing it.
So how?
The way I'm doing it now is just for you to understand, for you to learn. I'm not taking you through the process as it will happen in real time, because I have no idea how it will happen with you in real time. For some people, the first stage can take a long time. And in certain of the books, it will say that when the form aggregate starts to decrease, that actually you can see it in people for weeks or months beforehand. And certainly when my father, before my father died, certainly I could see this huge change. I mean, he wasn't ill, but you could see the whole change in his physicality. The loss of power, the looseness of the limbs, the vitality gone, and yet still doing what he was doing, the lack of luster. Sometimes that can last for a long time.
Right.
You can get, you know, and some, and certainly some of the lamas have said, you know, they have, there's other visions that come to people who know they're going to die. Tends to be linked to the form element. So sometimes that can go on for a while. It's quite handy, though, I think. Mm-hmm. Be quite handy if you could feel it in yourself, form element. But you don't know. You honestly don't know. It could be over. The way it was explained to me is it could be over like that. Mm-hmm. It could be over like, or it could take longer. And I presume some stages will take longer or shorter. All depends on your karma. All depends also, a lot of it depends also on your physical body, what illnesses you have. You know, your physicality. You know, what type of pain is going on here. Also what's been happening in your mind. How drugs are being affected. You know, how your emotions are coming into it. Are you disturbed by the environment you find yourself in? Are you distracted by the people in the room? All of this will have a bearing. But what is absolutely sure, you will go through those stages. It's not sure that you'll recognise them.
That's my next question.
Yeah, not sure. You have to practice.
Yeah.
You have to practice. And one of the easy, well, not easiest, but one of the ways to do it is to practice falling asleep mindfully.
Mm.
But if you can study, and if you understand the processes, then you recognise them. You see, a lot of people recognise stuff and they don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, well, that's not the right way to do it, you know. First of all, find out what you should be doing, what you should be recognising, and then use that as a mirror. Oh, yeah, here it comes, here it comes, here it comes. This is why they say, listen to the teachings, reflect, study, then meditate. Know what you're looking for, know what you're meditating on. For some people, maybe it's going to be very clear. I don't know. But if you don't have any teachings, all you'll think about is, oh, must be the drugs. You know, you have no idea where you are. You're still thinking you're going to wake up. And then suddenly you can't taste anything. You can't move your tongue. Can you imagine the fear?
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what's going on, I'm not saying, you know, you won't have fear, but maybe a wee bit more control. I've often thought a lot of this is about control.
So is there any evidence or any thought of becoming stuck in any of them? Can you become stuck in any of the stitches once you pass over, like in Bardo, for example?
Get stuck in the Bardo?
Yeah.
What they say is every 7 days, if you haven't found a body, there's a mini-death and a mini-rebirth in the Bardo until 49 days. And they, what they say is that, that you don't stay any longer in the 49 days. That something, you know, you will take a birth.
Right, I remember you saying that before. Mm.
Anything else about the meditation? Did you like the meditation?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Is it something you think you could practice? Good. If you memorised at least the visions, do you think that would help you fall asleep a wee bit mindfully? It's very exciting. I mean, it is. You know, instead of going, oh, well, you know, oh, stage one, great. That's oh, stage two. Very nice, very nice. See, everything that we're talking about here, as I say, comes from tantric practitioners who do this process. That's their almost their entire practice, and they report back. But the thing about the Dharma, especially this type of Dharma, is that it's experiential. It's supported and sustained through 25 centuries of people doing it and achieving it. And that's what we have to do. We don't listen and believe. We do it and achieve. That's what we do.
We do.
Do it and achieve it. Mm. So what about then... Yeah. So nothing else but... Okay. What about the... how we're going to help ourselves and others at the time of death?
Just going back
to... Oh, we're going back, okay.
Rupinder and I felt that we would really like... Well, we both came to the death weekend and thought we were going to go away and practice this, and then we just got into bed. So we thought if there was a CD that we could play with your voice guiding us...
My voice. Oh my
or
lord.
Or somebody.
Yes.
Then...
Or search online, there'll be something.
Oh, you think it'll be online?
Of course. And it'll be on here. You can ask for a copy for something like that. But really, I mean, that's good. That's nice. But why rely on someone else?
Well, just until you get... Because what happened is, like, I put this by my bedside.
Yes.
And I was just like, all right, okay, lots of physics. It was just too much to memorise.
Then don't memorise at all. Memorise the first stage. Or the first two stages.
Do it a little bit by
Even listening to someone's voice, that's not going to guarantee that you'll get each stage.
It was just till you'd become so familiar with it that you could...
You know, ask them for a copy. If you think that will help...
Yeah.
Of course, of course. I mean, I'm a great believer in using anything and everything that's around. But I am not a great believer in relying on it.
Well, no, just till you felt...
We say that. We say that. Now, I want you to think, if that worked for you or was reasonable, right, how sure are you that you wouldn't just rely on that? How sure are you that you would actually then study and practice and remember it? Well, the only way you can be sure is, what's my habit till now?
To let go once I don't need it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have used meditation CDs.
Of course. There's nothing wrong. Meditation CDs are very helpful. I used them for a long time. A long time. Very useful. But I was very glad of the day I could stop using them and be happy with what I was doing. They are a help and a stage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Logically, exactly is true. But in reality, people end up relying so much on them, they don't move on from that. So if you can do it and move on, no problem. No problem. But just be wary of relying on anything external to you. I mean, it's helpful. If you see it as a step helping, that's excellent. But that's not our habit.
I've got a question about some of the stages where you know, the sort of like your conceptual thoughts and things cease to function. So does that mean if you've got a, say, like if your practice is sort of visualization, mantra recitation, which is linked to sort of speech, would you not be able, would you practice cease to function then, because you will have lost those tools with which you're engaging with the meditation?
I am not completely sure, but what I've been told is the concepts that go are the really gross concepts.
Okay.
This is why I gave you examples, you know, fear, jealousy, anger, joy, those type of things. But practice itself, depending on your ability to focus, realistically, unless you've done the practice, realistically, unless you've done Tantra, unless you've had strong Tantric teachings, and you have practiced this, the chances of you staying through all these stages are very, very, I would think, very limited. Quite limited. What I've done with you here, actually, is only a medium-type practice of the death process. It's a much higher form of the death process, which keeps everything here, but superimposes that, the movement of the winds, the internal winds, the movement of the drops within the central channel, the movement down of certain drops towards the heart, the movement upwards of certain drops from the bottom up, when they merge. And then there's something called the indestructible drop when that opens. So if you're doing this from a tantric level, you'd be following that. You'd be following that. But all that needs teaching. All that needs teaching and it needs study.
So that if you didn't have those instructions, would it be better then to have a practice which is more to do with trying to see the nature of the mind, recognise the nature of the mind?
Well, that's part of that's your foundation. That's your foundation, yeah, recognising the nature. Oh, you mean your only practice?
Yeah.
No.
Would it be better? Would it be better? Because you're like, you never know when you're going to die, right?
Right.
So you could go through this whole trying to learn Tantra thing, or you could try. Yeah. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. See, because if you take it on a sutra level, or on a Mahayana level, not on a tantric level, right?
Yeah.
Is it worth practicing touching and exploring? And becoming one with the nature of mind, absolutely, absolutely. In order to do that, you need to get rid of all the delusions, all the negativities. You need high levels of merit. You need to be able to purify clearly. Why? It's not like going in a room and going, now I know you're here somewhere, clear level of mind. Where are you hiding? Ah! There you are. It's not like that. It's not like that. That mind is the mind you're using now, only on the most subtle level. Okay?
Yeah.
It's not separate from you, and it's not separate from this mind, but it's just more subtle. So what we have to get that, you need to unclutter this. Get rid of these preconceptions. Get rid of these delusions. Stop seeing what you think you see as being real and solid and unchanging. You need all this. You need impermanence. To get hold of impermanence, you need your merit, you need your purification, you need to walk the path. This is the thing. You need to walk the path. Now, if you want to take that to an even higher level, where you want to follow that more subtle mind into the bardo, etc., you need tantric teaching. If you want to be able to capture clear light mind, most of us, difficult even for the first four stages. And we can only really, the last four stages are more difficult. You need teachings for that too. You do need that. Because you need to be able to recognise clear light mind when it arises.
Mm.
And don't get it mistaken for anything else. Mm. Don't mistake it for the mind of white appearance, for instance. Because you're in for a shock if you do. But if you know the stages and the visions that come, then fine, you're there. You can do it. Then you need the practice, years of, to be able to harness that. To harness that. Emptiness. True nature of reality. Because you're touching your clear light mind, you might as well. I mean, you've hit the jackpot, you're there and you can stay there. But you need your practice to get to that. to be able to control what's going on in the bardo needs a lot. So I know, I do know where you're coming from, I do, but if you want to harness the clear light mind and do things with it, if you want to be able to at least get past the first four stages and be with the mind as it becomes subtler and subtler and subtler, you need the teachings. And you need teachings on the subtle body, channel winds and drops. Because what we're doing now is a very straightforward version. And it's all true, this is all right, but you can put a lot more in that from a tantric point of view. Now, if that's there, and you can follow it with your mind, then yes. But if you said to me, if I can touch the clear light mind and stay with it, is that enough? I would be hard to put to say no, because it sounds right to me. But can you do it? Difficult. Without the teachings, without the practice. Just to be able to touch that clear light mind and stay with it. I don't see how you can go wrong with that. But could you use it to understand emptiness? Could you use it to become enlightened? Don't know. Even having strong shamatha won't be enough. We all want simpler practices, believe me. We all want simpler practices. But this is why they call Tantra the lightning path, the fast path. Because of all the paths, you know, there's Sutra path, Mahayana path, Tantric path. Not that I know anything about that, anyway. Mm-hmm. Anything else that came up?
But, well, that kind of answers what we were talking about. I was talking about that. Because I was going to ask what happens if you recognise the light. But what you're saying is that you actually need to practice to recognise that.
Yeah.
Okay. So in that practice... Okay, yeah, a little bit.
No, I mean, this is all good, but there's a whole load of stuff coming in here.
Yeah.
There's really no... unless you're primed, unless you're coming from previous lives that are very, very ripe, it takes a lot.
It was just the feeling when we did this meditation, my own feeling, I don't know if it's my ego or if it's my intuition, I don't know what it is, was... I don't want to come back and suffer.
But that sounds perfect to me. Who does? How wonderful. That's what you felt.
But
good.
I wanted to go into life. And I'm sure everybody does. And I'm not so fixed and attached that if I do go through and I go back through, well, you know, I'm practicing Buddhism and doing everything, that I come back with more awareness.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it gets even more interesting.
Okay.
Well, you know, then you start looking at...
So I could go on and on and on.
I understand. No, really. Really, it's clear. But you see... yeah, it is clear. See, it's like, I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then we've got the idea that there is samsara, da-da... and there is some other heaven, and I'd rather go there, thank you, up here.
Yeah.
Yeah. When, yeah, the truth, they say the truth is really samsara and nirvana. We really have one taste. It's not that... right, I'm going to heaven, like you are in the Christianity.
Yeah.
You're not going anywhere, really. I mean, you could do. I mean, there's different Buddha fields and things like that. But actually, you could say samsara is a state of mind. Your state of mind. You could be sitting there fully enlightened. I could be sitting here in my normal state. We're both inhabiting, on one level, this world. But how I'm experiencing it and how you are will be totally different. Totally different. So you'd have to start looking into that as well. Because this idea of escape is escape from suffering, not escape to some place. Now, having said that, of course, there are different realms of existence for sure. And there are different, what's called Buddha fields, that you could be reborn in for sure. But if you think that samsara and nirvana are different, I don't think so. I don't really think so. They're of, what they say is they're of one taste. Yeah. And that's, and we're going to be looking at that after lunch. We're going to go into suffering. Because I thought, the morning spent on death, the afternoon and the evening on suffering, well, it's just a perfect day, isn't it? Just a perfect day. Don't think I don't plan these things well. So what about helping yourself at the time of death? Or helping others? I'm sure there was more about others. But, what did you come up with? Now, I know you came up with a lot because I could hear it. And I know you didn't get off, you know, didn't go off the questions. So what could you, you know, what could you do now to prepare for your own death? Or how could you help others? Just broadly speaking.
I felt I wanted to know the perfect mantra to be chanting at death.
The one mantra.
Yeah.
The one.
The one
ring mantra that binds them all. That one.
Okay. That was a simple thing.
So, where I would direct you to now is to look at Lama Zopa Rinpoche's book on death and dying. You have all the very powerful, the five most powerful mantras, and the mantras to do at the time of death. They're all clearly there. If you want a copy of them for someone who's dying, you won't be able to read it, but it's all there to put on, then I can give you that at the end. But actually,
yeah.
I can direct you there. It's very, extremely clear. These mantras are extremely clear. And there's also CDs available, can I just say? There's CDs available of chanting these mantras. And there is a beautiful one on it that helps with pain as well.
Mm-hmm.
CD for that. So certainly,
yeah.
Can I learn the mantra for that? Yes.
Yeah. What came up as well, which came up yesterday, it really strikes me how the process of dying seems to be like the process of giving birth for me.
Right.
It comes down to just me having to go through the process on my own and finding my own resources and finding what's going to keep me centred and grounded and on track in alignment with what's actually happening.
Yes.
And there's people around, but it's kind of, you know, nebulous and mopping my brow, but it's actually just down to me. So I felt a lot like in having given birth twice, that was like a preparation for death. And I was interested in the mirroring of that birth and death being a similar process.
Sounds interesting. Luckily, I have never given birth. Never interested me. However, I've been at the other end and helped deliver babies, certainly. Once I saw that, I thought, oh, unless they have a different way of doing this, that, you know. So, yeah, and so many mothers dying in childbirth. So much pain. And we're all around there, the doctors and nurses, the husband, whatever. What can I do? And really, there's nothing. They're on their own. Trying to do what seems to me impossible, the impossible, and in a lot of pain. He did it twice. Okay. Brave lady. Brave lady. But I think that might be worth exploring a bit. That sounds reasonable to me. Because that idea of being on your own, I think that's helpful.
Yeah, and having to find my own resources within myself, and it totally being about me and not anybody else around at all. So there's a lot of similarities, I think, in the death meditation.
Okay.
Birthing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. It seems reasonable. Oh dear, it's like pulling hen's teeth today. You'll be able to go to lunch soon. Tell me, how do you think you would prepare for your own death? What type of things came up?
I want you there, Mary.
Pardon?
I want you there.
You want me there, right? Right. Chanting in the corner. With my coffee cup in one hand.
Yes. No, I think, you know, creating cause to ideally have some Dharma friends there who, you know, will help with the actual process physically, but more important spiritually and mentally, would seem quite important, because I think it is, you know, Keith and I were talking about, you know, if we happen to have dementia or whatever, you know, it's not going to be easy, no matter how much we practice, to remember the visualization. So to have a Dharma friend there, or friends to help, would be an ideal, you know, without any attachment, sort of clinging. But
I find it interesting that even up to today, that it seems a very hit and miss thing, whether you have someone around you or not. And I don't think it should be hit and miss. I really don't. Mm. Hospices, they're on the way out, right? I mean, hospice at home, as you know. Mm. Most people don't live in centres. Mm. Most people don't live near centres. And when death and impermanence is so important, I do wonder why we fail to set up something that's actually useful to people in death. Why there isn't a round robin that we can tap into. We've tried. I mean, we had certainly at Jamyang Leeds, after one death weekend, we set up a system and a card, so that, you know, like a little credit card with the name and the address and, you know, who to contact for prayers and things like that. It lasted a little while, and then it kind of petered out. And I know other people in other groups, one in Copenhagen and another one, who've tried, they all know they like it, but it doesn't seem to get off the ground. So you tend to be reliant on friends. I think it should be more than that.
Yeah.
I think what we should, personally, what I think we should have is we should have, but what I'd like is if we had some sort of body, or we created a body that had, for instance, an insurance, a separate insurance, say for Buddhist funerals. Now, I know they're doing that. A friend of mine is involved in something like that in Holland. And so what they're doing there is people pay in to a group, because most of the ones in Holland and in here, they're in groups. The undertakers are in groups. And they contacted them, and what they've done is, it took a couple of years, but they set up an insurance scheme. And the Buddhists pay into that, and they get a Buddhist funeral. Now, what this person also did is he, of course, the undertakers want it, because money, they'll bury anybody, right? But the Buddhist people set up a kind of in-service training for the undertakers. Then they set up a contact list of people who can do Buddhist funerals and who to contact at the time of death. Now, it's not completely off the ground yet, but I often wonder, why don't we do something like that? Now, I know people want to do something. I know that. But we always seem to... I mean, I'm bringing myself into this mix as well, because it's something I've thought about, but I've seemed to be, like all of us, a bit too busy. But I wonder why we're too busy for this. It can't be that difficult to set up an insurance scheme for Buddhists. It can't. If they can do it in Holland, we can do it here. It can't be that difficult to set up an insurance business and a will writing service for Buddhists. Something that's for you, incorporated in all of this, it can't be that difficult to set up a scheme where it doesn't matter if you're living in Land's End or John O'Groats, when you're ill and dying, you can have these prayers done for you. Now, I know centres will do that if you ask the centres, but it's not quite the same thing. And also, people that would come and be with you at the time of death. This cannot be that difficult. And yet, this is why Buddhists my age had been at it a few times, right? We've been at it a wee while, eh? We're getting old. Where do we go? Where do we gravitate towards? Near centres. That's where we gravitate. As soon as we get to a certain age, I mean, Wendy and I having a chat going, you know, Where do we want to go and live? Where do we want to spend the last part of our lives? I tell you, 9 times out of 10, it's near a Buddhist centre. Now, in our part, it's a multilateral. We want to be able to help and to be able to be of service and to be of benefit to the centre. Of course. There's nothing else. I mean, what else are you going to do? But it's also so that we can be near a place so that when we do die, the chances of us having someone that may come and be with us at the time is much stronger. I just don't think it cannot be that difficult to do this. But I'm at fault. Older, I know people have tried, not quite the insurance thing, although I think that should definitely go, but you know, that's me. And the will writing and things like this. You know, something like that. But this type of thing, it can't be beyond dedicated people. People who want to take a couple of years and practice Dharma in that way. Make that your Dharma practice and leave a legacy like that. How wonderful. And we would all benefit. What do you think? Does it sound far-fetched?
Oh, it sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the fears I've had about, not about the actual death process of dying, but because I, have no contact with my family, I don't have any family other really than Ron and my friends, and because I've moved around so much, they're all over, it's like, am I really going to be by myself when I die? I don't really want that. You know, I'd like to have like-minded people, like,
yes,
talk about chanting. That's,
yep,
what I really would like.
Yes.
How do you achieve that? How do you do that?
With one of Wendy's friends and a lady I knew, Ronnie,
yeah,
because she'd been in the Dharma a long time, she had Dharma friends. And when she was dying, you know, Dharma friends travelled,
mm,
to be with her, to make sure she wasn't on her own, and, you know, took turns. And it was a service they gladly offered. I mean, it's not easy, but they gladly offered. I mean, most people who've gone through some training, who understand the death process, who understand a wee bit. I mean, there's lots of different levels of understanding that could be with you to help. Who amongst us wouldn't travel to help that person, really? And if one person couldn't do it for whatever reason, there's someone else. Then it needs to be a network. But you see, what we don't have is someone to organise this, someone to dedicate the time to this. We don't have that. We don't have people with computer skills. We don't have, well, we do, but not directed to this. We don't have people with management skills. We don't have people who are that interested in death. Right? But if we did, and that person dedicated their time to that, a year or two to set something like that up, imagine the network that would happen just in the UK. Just in the UK. And it wouldn't just be FPMT. It would be Buddhists. Anyway, that's me. Sorry. It's just that I'm quite inspired by what I've been watching for a few years. It took a while to get off the ground in Holland. But it's getting that way. It's, you know, I've got so much admiration. So, how else could you help yourself at the time of death?
Well, by practicing the 8 stages of dying seems very important.
Uh-huh.
In the lead up to that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
By living now in a manner which will make sure you don't have regrets.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. If you want to die in a certain way, live in a certain way.
And purifying the karma of the things you are regretting.
Sounds good. Yeah.
So what I think what I'm saying is, you could begin now.
Sounds right. Sounds right. I would direct you then to the Dharma books on death, to what's called the 5 powers. The 5 powers. And those 5 powers very clearly outline how you can benefit yourself at the time of death. Very clear. And what I like about the five powers, it's kind of concise. Right? Mostly when we hear what we can do, it seems a wee bit scattered. Whereas this gives you a wee bit of structure. The first power is called the power of the white seed. The power of the white seed. So what you're looking at here is you're looking at all the six parameters. You're looking at the six parameters. You're looking at purification. The second one is called the power of intention. And that's teaching you how to rely on the three jewels, motivation, bodhicitta. The next power is called the power of blaming the ego. And this is all about self-cherishing, seeing what self-cherishing is and how it strangles us and keeps us in samsara, and eliminating self-cherishing. The next power is called the power of prayer. And that's really, the power of prayer is all to do with not to be separated from bodhicitta. And in your prayers, if you pray never to be separated from bodhicitta, you pray, may I never be separated from bodhicitta in this life, the bardo, and all future lives. It's a prayer about emptiness, realizing emptiness. It's a prayer about no self-cherishing. And the last seed is called the seed of training. And what you're really doing here is habituating bodhicitta. Habituating bodhicitta. Now the teachings on that will help you prepare yourself for death, clearly. But interestingly, it prepares you for life. Because most of it is about the wisdom of emptiness, realizing, having some strong feeling for bodhicitta, and seeing the faults of self-cherishing. Most of that comes into the five powers, and there's different ways of doing that within these teachings. Very powerful. And really, that's how we should be living. The best thing you can do is to die with bodhicitta. They say, if you can die in refuge, if you can die with your teacher, your spiritual guide, clearly in your mind, relying on your spiritual guide. And if you rely on the three jewels, you're relying on your spiritual guide. And if you can die with the heart of bodhicitta, there's very little that can go wrong. His Holiness said that, because there's such a thing called poa, which is transference of consciousness. And he says bodhicitta is like a self-poa, like a self-poa. So that's why these five powers are very useful to come to grips with. And if you can do that, you use that as a template for helping others. What about, did you discuss about helping others? Did anything come to mind?
They did think, if you could die well, you could encourage others to die well. And then I thought to myself, David, that's self-cherishing again.
No.
That's ego again. Well, there's an element of it, isn't there?
Motivation is everything. Motivation is everything. If your motivation is to benefit others, and that's what you're doing, and that's what you aim for, that's not ego. Only you will know, of course, only you will know. But motivation is prime. Whenever you go to do something positive, especially if you're trying to help others, make sure your motivation is as pure as you can make it. And there's nothing better than a bodhicitta motivation. Nothing. Anything else? Did anything else come about helping others?
Well, we didn't discuss it, but talking about it now, I feel that, for me, I feel I need to understand I mean, I've worked with people in healing capacity of dying, but there comes a point where you're kind of shut out and then the family take over. But I feel, from my point of view, that I've got to understand this first before I can then impart that or help other people with that.
Yes. And you can use the skills you already have. I mean, Western skills. Counselling skills. Putting that person first. You know, more Rogerian approach, really putting the person in the centre of everything. And helping in that way, you could do that. But if you know the person and you know the practices they do, as Wendy was saying before when she was very ill, and she had a friend that was able to do the prayers for her, doing the prayers for her so she could hear it. How wonderful. But you'd need to know that. In Rinpoche's book, there's actually a sheet which says, you know, you can give this to people, you can fill it in. What practices would you like at the time of death? What type of mantras would you like saying? I've got mine filled. I know what, you know, really clear. But who am I going to give it to? Yeah, I know, I will. You know I will. But you just never know where you're going to be, who you're going to be with. I think it needs to be more organised. That's what I think. It shouldn't be down to the good fortune of having excellent friends. Yeah. It shouldn't be down to that. Right. So even now, if I'm dying, if I'm going to have a mantra playing, what one would I like? Of all the practices I do, if I can't do my practice, what is the main practice I would like someone to do? You know? Otherwise, please be very quiet. That's basically what I put in the very bottom. Because personally, I prefer silence. But the mantra, listening to, just to hear Rinpoche doing some mantra, you know, quietly in the mantras, in the background, yes, I'm just directing it, quietly in the background. I can't think of anything better. To have Rinpoche's picture in front of me that I can see, to have Lama Yeshe, to have his picture in front of me, to have somebody saying to me, if you remember, take refuge again, baby, take refuge again, more and more, fine. Doing a little bit of practice for me. Maybe for 10 minutes we're going to do some purification. Is that okay? Unless I jump out of the bed and go, no, do it, you know? And then in the end, very peaceful, very quiet. You can write this down. It doesn't take much. In Rinpoche's book, it's got, you know, what would you, you know, there's things you can write out. And that could be lodged somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it could be updated if you feel like it.
Yeah.
I just think it ought to be a bit more. I'm sorry, it could be a bit more. Okay.
Which book?
Death and Dying. Rinpoche's book on Death and Dying. Yeah, I put copies in here. It is a beautiful book. I love things that are really clear. Okay. So just for 5 minutes, breathing evenly and gently, allowing your mind to scan the different bits of death that we've talked about, coming to some form of conclusion, and then just rest with that. Just rest with that, just for 5 minutes. Thank you. So just before you go for lunch, just to say, as you know, on Wednesday, it's Mahayana precepts, eight Mahayana precepts. And on Thursday, the program will be exactly the same up until lunchtime. After lunchtime, for the rest of that day, you'll be conducting your own retreat. Okay. We did this last year, it was very good. Now, it's kind of half a day, and it's I'm doing it like that now so that, as you know, on the following Friday will be a full day of doing personal retreat. And if we do half a day now, anything comes up, any difficulties I can help with, anything that I can give advice on, I can do that. So we're going to do that on Thursday. So Thursday we're following the schedule all the way up until lunchtime. After lunch, you'll be very free to follow the schedule. That's not a problem. Follow the schedule. But you'll be conducting your own meditations. You'll be conducting your own retreat. I am very happy to give any advice if people need it. There are plenty of resources here for your meditations. Keith very kindly gifted us these copies of the Extended Lam Rim Outlines. All the handouts are here, you have your notes. But if you need anything else, I am more than happy to fill your day. Okay? But you may want to do more walking meditation. You may want to practice doing the deep relaxation shamatha, lying down. As Alan Wallace said to me, you won't always be able to sit up, Mary. When I told him I wasn't happy about doing it lying down. So sometimes it would be useful. If you're ill, or even if you're dying, don't expect people to always be sitting you up. You may be lying flat. So lying in the correct posture, the Shavasana posture, and practicing doing this meditation, the relaxation, the stability, the vividness, and then focusing on the breath, lying down, might be a really good use of your time. Lying down is not very helpful with analytical stuff, I have to say. But for other things, for relaxation and for a single-pointed concentration, there may be times when it will be helpful. It certainly has been for me, be able to do this lying down. Now you think, of course I could do it lying down, but actually I found it quite difficult because I'd fall asleep or I'd get really tired or I would, you know. So that it might be nice for you to practice that. Again, very happy to give any help if you need it. So I'm giving you a few days' notice to think about it. See if you can plan it in your head. If you need help, please ask. Thank you so much. Enjoy your lunch.